here. We got a full house. There must be something else going on down here or something tonight. I don't know. Wondered why half of Denver was gone this morning, but now I know. So good to see all of you here. I'd like to start with a couple of questions. Have you ever been misunderstood? Nobody? No? Okay. Well, I thought it was just me. Have you ever had somebody go around and say things about you behind your back, and you knew they weren't true, but you couldn't really stop it? Have you ever prayed for something for a long, long time and never heard an answer to that prayer for years, for decades? If any of these questions apply to you, you can probably identify with the two people we'll be talking about today, and that's Zechariah and Elizabeth. Today we'll be talking about the circumstances of what is called the announcing or the annunciation of the birth of John the Baptist to Zechariah and his wife Elizabeth. This may sound like something of a dry subject, but the more we dig into it, we'll find that the story has a lot of important lessons for us that we'll talk about as we go through this study today. We'll begin the story over in Luke 1 and verse 5. And in the harmony of the Gospels, we'll be covering the bottom of page 3 here. We won't cover a great deal. We actually will cover a great deal today, just not a whole lot of verses here. But there's an awful lot we can learn from this. And one of the things, one of the purposes for going into these studies is to help us understand the culture and the background of that time. Because if you don't understand that, you're really missing half, if not more, of the study, of the story that God has preserved for us. So we'll talk about that quite a bit today. You know, today we're 2,000 years removed from those events. We live in a very different culture. We're separated by language barriers from what happened there. The original story has been written there in Greek. And again, just a lot of ways that we do not understand what is going on. And consequently, a lot of it just goes right over the top of our heads, as hopefully we'll see today. So begin the study here in Luke 1 and verse 5, and we'll cover down through verse 25 here. And the story starts off, there was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea. So this takes place in the time of Herod the Great. We talked about him in the background, one of the background messages for these studies. This is a statuary head that is believed to be of Herod the Great. This is the Herod the Great we covered then. He's the Herod who was the great builder, built the Jerusalem temple, for instance. We'll be talking about the temple quite a bit today. He was also, as we discussed in the background message earlier, a ruler who was paranoid and as a result was quite brutal, which we'll get to in the Gospels here in another couple of classes here. Herod died in the year 4 BC, as near as we can tell. And the events that we'll be discussing today take place in probably 5 B.C., a year, year and a half, 2 years, perhaps on the outside, before the death of Herod the Great. Now, in mentioning Herod, as Luke does here, Luke doesn't bother to give us the details. We covered a little bit of that earlier, but what kind of ruler was Herod? Herod was well known for his reputation in that day and age. I mentioned the quote in the earlier background about Herod that one of the Roman emperors said, "I would rather be Herod's pig than his dog, than his son," because Herod was, dog, I've got dogs in my mind, sorry about that, don't know why, but yes, I'd rather be Herod's pig than his son, because Herod killed off so many of his own family members, had his own favorite wife murdered, had several of his sons murdered, various other relatives there. So this was the type of reputation that Herod had. They knew also that Herod had built the temple. Here's a computer simulated illustration of the great temple there in Jerusalem. This is from one of the porches where Jesus and later the apostles would have taught. They're looking at the temple, the structure back in the background. But they also knew that in addition to building the temple, Herod controlled the priesthood. The priesthood had no longer been, at least the high priest, I should say, to clarify here, the priests were still generally descended from Aaron, but the high priest had become a position to be bought and sold. It was very heavily politically influenced at that time. You might remember how how Jesus Christ described the priest that he confronted during his ministry about 30 years after that. What did he call them? Called them vipers, snakes, brood of serpents, hypocrites, this kind of thing. So the priesthood had become quite corrupt at this point in Jewish history here. It was starting. It would get much worse later on at the point Jesus Christ is crucified. But this was part of the background of the story here. We also need to keep in mind, what was the state of God's people there in Judea? They were controlled by the Roman Empire. They lacked the freedom to govern their own affairs. They had a Roman governor over them there. So the Jews at that time were prayerfully pleading with God to be delivered from these circumstances, to have this Roman overlord, the Roman overlords, thrown out, so that God's kingdom, which they knew prophetically would come, would be established there, and also to restore to them right spiritual leadership in the country by getting rid of the corrupt priests and religious leaders and replacing them with a righteous priesthood. So this is the context in the story that Luke leaves out, because everybody was aware of it when Luke is writing the story. But this is what is going on. So in mentioning, so Luke begins his story then that this is when things start to take place. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, and all the loaded information that goes with that, which I've just explained, a certain priest named Zacharias, or in Hebrew, Zechariah, there. The Bible doesn't tell us anything about the parents of Zechariah, but it's interesting, why did they pick that name? Why pick the name Zechariah? Let's just think about that for a minute. Because Jewish parents in those times gave children, gave names to their children that they would, for lack of a better term, would convey their hopes and their dreams and essentially the destiny of that child. They didn't pick out a name just like it sounded good today, like Connie or Robert or Mary or Heather or Jessica or something like that. No, they picked out a name because to them they wanted that name to have spiritual significance. Like my name, Scott, means tattooed wild man. Not sure what the significance of that is. Afraid to ask my parents all these years, but they would give names to their child that did have spiritual significance. Again, what they thought that child would grow up to be. Name them after a famous relative or something, which we see repeatedly in the scriptures as well. So why would they have chosen to name their son, the priest, Zechariah? Anybody think of another famous Zechariah in the Bible? About 500 years earlier, there was a priest and a prophet named Zechariah who gave us the book in the Minor Prophets that bears his name. What are the themes of the prophetic book of Zechariah? In that day, his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives. One of the major themes of the book of Zechariah is the coming of the Messiah. What are some of the other themes? Themes about the kind of rule the world will experience under the Messiah. The restoration of a right and proper and righteous priesthood. It's all about God's transformation of the world under the coming of the Messiah. Why would Zechariah's parents have chosen to name him Zechariah? Could it be because they were thinking and hoping and wishing that the time would come for God to intervene and send the Messiah and get rid of the corrupt priesthood that is developing there and overthrow the Romans and toss them out? What about the name Zechariah? What does it mean? Zechariah has the name of God in it. Yah, as in Yahweh at the end of it, which a lot of biblical names do. It means remembered by God. Remembered by God. Why did they choose to name their son Zechariah? Could it be because they are hoping that God will remember his promises to establish a right priesthood and to establish the kingdom of the Messiah on earth? Don't know for sure, but I think it's interesting when you understand the background of what the Jews were going through at that time, that yes, these are why they would have named their son Zechariah, because they are anticipating the time of the coming of the Messiah and the establishment of his kingdom here on earth. Again, can't prove it, but considering the culture, I think that makes perfect sense as to why they would have chosen that particular name. And of course, Zechariah would always be reminded of his namesake, the one he is named for, the great priest who was also a prophet of God, the earlier Zechariah who had lived 500 years earlier there. So continuing on here in verse 5, picking up the story here, it says this, that this priest, Zechariah, was of the division or the course of Abiah. Abiah in Hebrew here. And what is this talking about? We'll cover this in more detail next time when we get into the timing of Jesus Christ's birth. But just to give you a little brief overview of it, you might write down in your notes 1 Chronicles 24, verses 3 through 19. We won't talk about all of those, but we'll just hit the high points here. What happened is, this is near the end of David's life, to understand the setting, and he's starting the preparations for the temple that his son Solomon is going to build after David passes away from the scene. And he has an issue going on there because there are far more priests. This gets back to the return from Babylon, back in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, Zerubbabel, and so on. Far more priests and Levites come back compared to the rest of the population. So there's basically a surplus of priests. So what David does is he divides up all of the priests into what are called courses or divisions, 24 of them. And each of them are given names. And this is describing the process here. And what he's going to do is set up a system where the priests rotate one group at a time instead of trying to have all of them come in and serve in the tabernacle or the temple at that time, because it's far too small for thousands of priests to serve in at that time. So the story here, then David with Zadok of the sons of Eleazar and Ahimelech of the sons of Ithamar, these are descendants of Aaron, divided them, talking about the divisions of the descendants of Aaron, who were the priests, according to the schedule of their service. So he's setting up a schedule whereby the priests will serve. Verse 5, thus they were divided by lot, so they're casting lots to determine the order in which these different groups of priests will serve, one group as another, for there were officials of the sanctuary and officials of the house of God, referring to the temple or the tabernacle at that time, but it would become the temple, from the sons of Eleazar and from the sons of Ithamar. Continuing on. I loaded a new version of PowerPoint on my computer this week. So, and then it describes how the lots fell. The first lot fell to Jehoram, the second to Jediah, the third to Harim, the fourth to Seorim, the fifth to Malchijah, the sixth to Majamin, the seventh to Hakaz, and the eighth to Abiah, which is the one we're talking about here, from which to the course to which Zechariah belongs. And then it goes on to list all 24 courses, which we won't go through. And it concludes by saying this was the schedule of their service for coming into the house or the temple of the Eternal, according to their ordinance, by the hand of Aaron their father, as the Eternal God of Israel had commanded him. So this is describing the system that is set up here. And again, we'll talk about this more next time when we get into the timing of the actual birth of John the Baptist and Jesus Christ. And just to give you a hint, this gives us a starting point for this when we understand when these courses served. I don't have time to go into it, but if you have a copy of the Companion Bible, or you can look it up online as well. He has a very detailed explanation of it there and describes how, basically at this time, the course of Abiah served in December and June. So we'll get into the evidence for why it was June later, but for now we'll just say it begins in June. This begins a countdown of 9 months to the birth of John the Baptist and then another 6 months until the birth of Jesus Christ the Messiah. So 15 months in there. So if you start in June and you add 15 months to that, you do not get to December 25th. Hint of coming attractions there. So anyway, let's see, where am I here? So the way this worked then, you have 24 courses of priests, and each course served a cycle of 1 week from Sabbath to Sabbath. And so the first course would serve for a week. The starting began at the end of the Feast of Tabernacles. So the very next week, the first course would serve. The next week, the second course, and so on, till you get to the eighth course of Abia, which fell in December at this time. And also, all of the courses of priests would come in and serve during the three pilgrimage feasts. That's the term used for the Passover / Days of Unleavened Bread, and for Pentecost, and for the Feast of Tabernacles. There, all of the priests would come in to serve at that time. So it would work out where you would have each course of the priests would serve 2 1-week shifts during the year, and then they would all come in for the other 3 weeks of the year as well. So continuing on back here, and Luke, chapter 1 and verse 5, talks about Zechariah's wife. His wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. So we have Zechariah, who is of a priestly family, and also his wife Elizabeth is of a priestly family, a direct descendant of Aaron as well. What is her name? Elizabeth in Hebrew would have been Elisheba, which means oath of God. We don't know anything about the oath, but her parents chose to name her that. Perhaps the oath was she would marry a priest and carry on the priestly line or something like that. We just don't know anything about her other than she was a descendant of Aaron as well. Verse 6, and they were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord blameless. So Luke tells us that they were righteous, they walked in all God's commandments, and they were blameless. Doesn't mean they were perfect. No one is perfect, no human being at least. But it does tell us that they loved God. And they loved Him from the heart. It wasn't just show, in other words. They weren't just going through the motions, but they sincerely and deeply loved God and wanted to please Him and obey Him in everything that they did. Now you might contrast this with what we read later on about the state of the priesthood when Jesus Christ is having His encounters with them. Again, He calls them snakes, vipers, hypocrites, this kind of thing. So it does show that the priesthood was quite corrupt, but not Zechariah. He was a righteous and blameless man before God, along with his wife Elizabeth. So far, so good. And then Luke introduces something into the story that is absolutely shocking to the people of that time and the culture of that day. He tells us in verse 7, but they had no child because Elizabeth was barren and they were both well advanced in years. As the King James Version puts it, I think, well stricken in years. They were getting on up there. Those of you getting older, you know what I mean. You can identify with that, being stricken in years there. So in the culture of that day, that just did not compute. Because you read through the Psalms, there's the one Psalm that we sing about, blessed is he who has his quiver full of arrows, talking about children. And what a blessing they are. And you find that repeated throughout the Bible. Children are a blessing from God. So if a couple did not have children, how were they viewed? They were viewed as, there's got to be something wrong with them. They must be engaged in some kind of secret sin, and God is punishing them for not having children. Trivia question. What's the first commandment in the Bible? Mr. Wilkie read it in his sermon today. Be fruitful and multiply. So if you are not having children, you are disobeying God's command to be fruitful and multiply. And that's the natural order of things. And if you're not having children, obviously something is wrong with you, and God is punishing you. And this is the situation with Zechariah and Elizabeth. Luke doesn't have to mention any of this. It's all, it was all understood in the culture of that day. That was just common. Doesn't mean it was right. Just means that's the way it was. Can you think of any other parallels to this kind of situation? Any other biblical characters? Abraham and Sarah. Big one. Huge one. How old was Abraham and Sarah when they had children? I think Abraham was 100, if I remember. Sarah was 90. Just quite old. Yes, Arthur. Yes. Yes, good. Hannah, yes, waited years and years, and finally she was able to bear the prophet Samuel. Here. So here's two references. You can write down Genesis 17 and 18 and 1 Samuel 1, the story of Hannah there. A few others as well, but these are the most notable ones there, where these individuals prayed and prayed, desired children for years, and it didn't happen there. So how do you feel when you feel that God isn't answering your prayers? How long have you prayed for something? For years? I know I have. Not had those prayers answered. Certainly not in the way that I expected them to be answered there. But this is the case of Zechariah and Elizabeth. They had married years before, and no doubt they expected them, especially being a priest and a priesthood, that she would probably become pregnant in her first year. Incidentally, a little side note, men generally married at about age 20 at that time. Please note, these are not recommendations. But the girls married at about age 13. And the reason for that was, as soon as they would start menstruating, be able to bear children, again, what's the first command of the Bible? Be fruitful and multiply. So that was considered a gift to them, that at that point in their age, when they began menstruation, they could begin bearing children there and become mothers. And that was considered a gift there in the culture of that day. Again, that's just strictly factual, no recommendations there. So they would have married at about these ages in all likelihood there. And the first year goes by and Elizabeth has no children. She's not pregnant. Another year goes by. 5 years go by. 10 years go by. Another decade goes by. By this time, probably 40 or more years have gone by, and she's barren. And it becomes evident that the time for bearing children has passed them by. And there were all the whispers going on this entire time. Well, we know that God blesses us with children, and Zechariah and Elizabeth are not blessed with children. Therefore, there must be some secret sin that God is punishing them for. Probably even within their own families, they were looked down on, ostracized there because of that. Because it was just understood that if you didn't have children, God is punishing you. The rabbis actually taught that at that time there, that there were only two types of afflictions in life where God would not be using punishment to chasten you for your good. In other words, there were two types of punishment that were always bad, and that was leprosy and being childless. That was a teaching of some of the rabbis at that time. Again, it doesn't mean it was true, by no means. But that was the thinking of the time there. So eventually it got to the point where it was obvious that their childbearing years are over there. And it says here they were well advanced in years. Their time for bearing a son to carry on the family line was simply past. And that's a key part of the background for this story. There's a huge amount of information packed into these few verses. And if you don't understand the culture, if you don't understand the context and the background, all of this goes right over our heads and we miss it. So that's why I'll be spending a lot of time in these studies going into the background to help us understand the lessons to learn there. The kind of hurt that Zechariah and Elizabeth experienced from not having children during that time. The ways they would have been ostracized, looked down on, and people whispering behind their backs things that were not true, thinking that they had to be involved in some kind of sin, that God is cursing them by not allowing them to bear children there. That's part of the backstory that Luke doesn't explain, but it's such a part of the culture of the day that anybody reading this at that time would have known what he's talking about there and would have understood and sympathized with him because of that. So continuing on here, in verse 8, continuing with the story. So it was that while Zechariah was serving as priest before God in the order of his division, the course of Abiah again, according to the custom of the priesthood, his lot fell to burn incense when he went into the temple of the Lord. Let's talk about another backstory that's going on here. The temple, let's talk about that a little bit here too, to help understand, better visualize this. So let's see here. Okay, the temple. This is a another computer simulation, one of the neatest graphics I've come across yet. This is actually a computer model laid over the topography of Jerusalem there, the kind of the, roughly the view you would get from above the Mount of Olives looking down on the city of Jerusalem. And you can see by the size of the Temple Mount, this huge rectangular platform there, approximately 30 acres in size there, just dominated the whole city of Jerusalem, spread out on the far side of it. You can make out the city walls over there. And it was just enormous, dominated the whole skyline. It was elevated above the rest of the city there. And just a huge, huge structure. This item here is a bridge that ran across the Kidron Valley to the Mount of Olives. You can see some of the olive groves outside the city and so on. And, of course, the massive temple there. How big was it? Let's take a look at another graphic here, a front view of it. For scale, notice the priests dressed in white down here in front of the gate before the temple. Huge, huge structure. Beautiful, gleaming white limestone there with gold, solid gold trim and highlights over it. Beautiful, beautiful structure. Truly one of the wonders of the ancient world there. So this gives you some idea of the size of it. Now, if you went inside where the next part of our story takes place, this is what it would have looked like on the inside here. You have several priests. And looking around, some of the items you'll recognize, some may not be as familiar. You'll recognize what is referred to in the Bible as the candlestick. It's a menorah. That's why that's the symbol you find in a lot of Judaism there, the menorah. Then over on this side, you see a strange-looking object over here, plated in gold. That is the table for the showbread, where the showbread would be placed there. And then there's this box-like object right here. And that is the altar of incense there. That is where Zechariah is going to offer the incense there in this part of the temple. This part of the temple, incidentally, is called the Holy Place. And you see also this large tapestry or curtain back here. That was separating off a huge, huge curtain embroidered with cherubim. And behind that was the Holy of Holies, where the presence of God was thought to be there. So when we envision the story of Zechariah, this helps you understand more of what is going on here. One major difference, though, is Zechariah is in there by himself. He's totally alone. The room, just to give you a rough idea, would be approximately the size of this room here. That'll help us kind of get a little bit of a scale to it. Probably a little bit smaller, narrower here, but approximately the same size there. So, continuing on here, getting ahead of myself here. So, Zechariah is completely alone when he goes in here to offer the incense here. And let's see, actually I left out a part here. Let me find that. Oh, actually I was ahead of myself here. So, yes, Zechariah would have been coming in and offering. He would have been standing on this side of the altar of incense and facing the Holy of Holies and the curtain there as he offered that. And the incense represented what? Represented prayers ascending to God. Yes, very good. You might write down a few verses here, Revelation 5 and verse 8. I won't take the time to read through them. Also, Revelation 8 and verses 3 and 4. And this talks about the connection between incense and prayers and how the incense does represent the prayers of God's people. And offering this incense on the altar would create steam and smoke that would fill the holy place there. And there was also a hole in the roof, and the incense and the smoke would go out the hole in the roof. And outside, because this took place at the time of the morning and afternoon sacrifices, the people would be gathered outside the temple praying, and they would see this visual of the smoke rising up through the roof of the temple, and it would represent their prayers. They knew it represented their prayers rising up to God there. It's a very graphic teaching tool. God uses a lot of visual teaching tools throughout the Bible. Just a few of them. Baptism, for instance. What does baptism picture? Pictures you going down in a grave and rising up to new life out of that grave. Anointing with oil is something the ministry does. What's the symbolism of the oil? The healing power of God's Spirit. The Passover symbols, bread and wine that God gives us to represent God, Christ's broken body and his blood. God uses a lot of symbols to teach us lessons. And the incense is another one of many symbols like that. The whole sacrificial system we don't have time to get into. But God does use a lot of things like that that modern Christianity wants to toss out, say that's old and irrelevant and all that. But it's not. God uses those things as teaching tools for us. And this is a clear example of that there. So by the time Jesus comes on the scene here, the number of priests numbered somewhere, depending on which estimate you read, somewhere between 20 and 30,000 priests here. Again, there's a much larger percentage of priests there compared to the normal proportion there would have been in the population. So again, the priests served in weekly shifts, 1 week at a time, and about 1,000 at a time, about 1,000 priests. Now, in these shifts, there was another process to choose priests for four specific duties, and these were considered honored duties. And those four duties were to offer the morning and afternoon sacrifice, to wash at the bronze sea, the huge bronze basin that was outside of the temple as well, and also to place the bread on the table of showbread within the holy place there. And the fourth and the most honored one, because it was the closest to God's presence in the holy place, was to offer the incense on the altar of incense burning there. So these, so you can do the math a little bit. You have four priests chosen. You have 1,000 in your course. Your course serves 2 weeks a year, plus the 3 weeks for the holy days and festivals when there's 25,000 of you coming in there. Do the math. What are your odds of being chosen for one of these positions? I'll do the math for you. It's about 1 in 80 years, which means that the average priest in his lifetime may do it once. And it was so rare that they came up with a rule that you can't do it twice. If you do it once, you can never do it again until every other priest in the 1,000 priests in your course has done it. So most priests might do it once in a lifetime. The others would, in all likelihood, never do it at all. So we come to an aged, elderly priest by the name of Zechariah. How old is Zechariah? He's well stricken in years. My guess, he's probably 70 to 80, somewhere along in there. Doesn't have long to go. He served in the priesthood for 40 to 50 years at this point. And he's never been chosen. He's seen many younger priests in the same course chosen for these honored responsibilities, but not him. Meanwhile, what are people saying about his wife, Elizabeth? There's got to be some secret sin. Elizabeth's barren. She's got to be punished by God. Zechariah's never been chosen. Must be some secret sin. Again, this is part of the backstory here. Luke doesn't spell it all out, but you put it together in the culture and context of the time, and you can understand what's going on. And then the day comes when they're choosing the lot, a process, not exactly casting lots, it was based on chance, but it's a long involved explanation and procedure we don't have time to cover here. But this year, the course of Abiah is serving at the temple, and they choose the four priests for these four responsibilities that I mentioned earlier. And it comes time to choose the priest for the most honored of these duties. And lo and behold, the lot falls on the elderly priest, Zechariah. At last, his time has come to do this. You have to think about how this old man felt at this point, because again, he'd spent 30, 40, maybe as many as 50 years in service as a priest, and it's always passed him by. And decades have passed by, and he has to be wondering, you know, will I ever be chosen? Am I truly being punished by God for something that I don't even know? And now he is finally chosen to offer the incense on the altar. And the people are gathered outside again to pray, because this takes place at the time of the morning or evening sacrifice. We don't know which one or the other there. So Zechariah takes the bowl of incense there. We don't know what it is, perhaps frankincense, myrrh. We just don't know. There are about 18 different common types of incense that day, and the Bible just does not spell it out. So this has to be the highlight of his lifetime as a priest, because he's finally chosen for this honored duty and responsibility to do this. So he slowly, he changes, puts on the proper garments there, and he slowly and reverently approaches the altar there, the altar of incense. Just a few feet away behind the altar is the curtain separating the Holy of Holies, where God is, as far as he views it there, the presence of God. And perhaps with hands trembling a little bit because of age, he approaches this. The weight of what he's doing is the realization of the heavy responsibility and honor that is bearing down on him. And he begins the prayer that was to be offered at that time. If you're Zechariah, what do you pray for? Did he think, this is as close to God as I'm ever going to be, so I'll pray for a son one more time? Did he pray that? We don't know, but I think it's quite a realistic possibility. He was certainly familiar with Abraham and Sarah and Hannah and others. Knew nothing is impossible with God. Perhaps he did pray for a son there. We don't know. We just don't know for sure. But there is one thing we do know. I've mentioned earlier the Mishnah, a collection of Jewish writings from approximately 100 to 200 years after the time the Gospels were written. And it records the traditions and the customs and the practices of the Jewish religious practice back for the previous centuries there. And knowing their traditions, they stuck with them for a long time. You know, like the song in Fiddler on the Roof, tradition, you know, is very important to them. So they kept these traditions for many, many years. And in the Mishnah, it records the prayer that was offered by the priest who was offering the incense on the incense altar. And we don't know 100% that this is correct. Again, it's separated a century or two from the time these events take place. But considering how meticulously they recorded everything and followed tradition, I think it's safe to say this is probably very close, if not the actual prayer. So picture Zechariah, this elderly priest, standing before the altar of incense, ready to offer that bowl, pour that bowl on the hot coals there. And he starts praying. And in his prayer is a line that goes like this: send us the one who will prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. Does that blow your mind? It does mine. It does mine. So this elderly priest prays before the altar of incense, and he utters these words, as far as we can tell: send us the one who will prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. And then next thing he knows, there's a presence there with him. And he's not alone. And he's supposed to be alone. And he is scared to death. What happens next? Then an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And what's Zechariah's reaction? When Zechariah saw him, he was troubled. I think that's an understatement. And fear fell upon him. How do we know he was terrified? Well, notice what the angel says. First words out of the angel's mouth: do not be afraid. Because Zechariah is probably trembling there because of this apparition, this angelic being that has suddenly appeared in this room where he's supposed to be all alone offering the incense there upon the altar. A very frightful experience. But this is a profound answer to prayer. Has God ever answered your prayers that quickly? Yes, Arthur. Yes. Could be. I haven't found that. I did come across the prayer that they offered. Well, this is another interesting sideline I wasn't going to get into. But Zechariah is supposed to come out after offering this and lead everybody in a prayer of blessing for the people of Israel. And he prays and the people respond. But Zechariah's got a problem, which we'll come to in a minute. He can't talk. So, anyway. So no, we don't know, but I think that's quite possible, especially considering the culture of the time that we talked about. What would the people have been praying for? They would have been praying for deliverance. They would have been praying for the Messiah. They would have been praying for the kingdom of God to come to earth and restore the nation and restore right leadership and so on there. So I do, yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but that's certainly a very realistic possibility that they would have been doing there. So here this angel suddenly appears to Zechariah, who has apparently prayed for the one who would prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. And the angel tells Zechariah that he is to name his son John. John in English or Greek. In Hebrew, it would have been Yochanan. Yochanan. Y-O-C-H-A-N-O-N. Yochanan there. Meaning God is a gracious giver. God is a gracious giver. Now, think about that for a minute. Again, the Bible has a lot of significance to names there. So this angel tells Zechariah that he's about to give him the gift that Zechariah has waited for his entire adult life, which is a son. And what's he to name that son? God is a gracious giver. Think about that. Just think about that there. So every time Zechariah is going to say his son's name, Yochanan, he's going to be reminded, God is a gracious giver. And John, every time he hears his name pronounced for the rest of his life, he's going to be reminded that God is a gracious giver. He's going to be reminded that an angel appeared to his father Zechariah while he was serving in the temple and said, you're going to have a son, and this son is going to prepare the way for the coming of the Messiah. And it's a constant reminder to Zechariah of this miracle, and a constant reminder to John the Baptist of this miracle, that God is a gracious giver. God is a gracious giver, and that John's birth is the result of a miracle from God in allowing Zechariah and Elisha to have a son in their old age. I don't know how that strikes you, but to me, again, it's just incredibly powerful. Think about this. God used a system, the system of the priesthood and the tabernacle, followed by the temple. When did he establish that? Established that during the period of the Exodus from Egypt and before they entered the Promised Land. This is 1400 to 1450 years earlier. And then the timing of it. When does David set up the courses of Abijah? Of Abiah and all the priesthood and they're rotating and all that. Sets it up about 1,000 years earlier than this. So God is using a system of timing and ritual and symbolism and pictures and so on. It's been established more than 1,000 to 1,450 years earlier. And God is perfect with his timing because he waits for the time for an elderly, aged priest who cannot have a son to come and offer the incense and to pray the prayer, send us the one who will prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. And bam, an angel appears and says, your prayer is answered. Is God a master of perfection and planning and precision and timing or what? He's not a God of random chance. He's not a God who just lets things happen. He's a God of perfection and planning and precision in everything he does. Working for 1,450 years to bring this about.
at the perfect time. Just amazing. Absolutely amazing. This does show us also that God is always faithful. And as Zechariah's name tells us, he is a God who remembers. A God who remembers his promises. The prophecies that he would send one who would prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. Continuing the story, verse 14. The angel tells Zechariah, "And you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth. For he will be great in the sight of the Lord, and shall drink neither wine nor strong drink. He will also be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb." So this son, Yochanan, is to have a special mission in life. He would be great in God's sight. He would possess God's Spirit in him, even from his birth. This is not saying that he would be conceived by the Holy Spirit, as Jesus Christ is, directly conceived by God's Spirit, but he would be filled with God's Spirit. Yes?
A
lot of people think that because of he will drink neither wine nor strong drink. Yes, Samson and Samuel were. It's quite possible. It just doesn't specify one way or the other. But yes, the Nazarite vow there. Samson, if I'm not mistaken, was Nazarite from birth too, and Samuel too, I believe there. Possible. Bible just doesn't directly say one way or the other. But yeah, if you want to look into that, yes, there is the Nazarite vow where someone would be dedicated to God. They would not cut their hair, for instance. They would not drink any product of the grape, which would be wine, any fermented grape juice, which is wine or so on. But it wasn't just wine or strong drink, also prohibited in anything made from grapes there as well, lest it be turn to alcohol or have some kind of alcohol content in there. So yes, quite possibly was. Scripture just doesn't specify one way or the other for sure about that. So continuing on in the story, verse 16, "And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God." In other words, he is going to be a witness for the Messiah, the coming Messiah, Jesus. And he would be the one who would come before him. Verse 17, "He will also go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah." And you might want to write down several scriptures. We won't cover them in depth here. But Matthew 17, verses 11 through 13. This is where Jesus is discussing with his disciples. "And he said to them, 'Indeed, Elijah is coming first and will restore all things.'" We talk about prophecy being dual. Actually, in the case of Elijah, there's three fulfillments of that. There was the original prophet Elijah, there was John the Baptist, and there's an end-time Elijah as well. So prophecy sometimes isn't just dual, it's triple, or whatever the word for that would be. Verse 12, Jesus Christ goes on to say, "I say to you that Elijah has come already, but they did not know him." And continuing on, verse 13, "Then the disciples understood that Jesus spoke to them of John the Baptist." So John was fulfilling some of these prophecies. What were some of the prophecies? Malachi 3 and verse 1, "Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight. Behold, he is coming, says the Eternal of Hosts." And of course, the next chapter of Malachi, familiar passage, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Eternal. And he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse." A familiar passage there with us. So John the Baptist was fulfilling some of these prophetic roles that we read about here. And picking it up in Luke 1 and verse 17, where he's quoting here from where Gabriel, the angel, is quoting from Malachi. And says, "He will also go before him, the Messiah, in the spirit and power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children," quoting directly from Malachi. and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. And then Zechariah is obviously stunned by this sudden appearance of the angel Gabriel and his message. And Zechariah said to the angel, who is unnamed at this point, "How shall I know this? For I am an old man, and my wife is well advanced in years." So Zechariah just apparently blurts out the first thing that comes to his mind. How can this be? I'm 80 years old, and my wife is 70, or whatever numbers you want to insert there, probably again between 60 and 80 there. And obviously, however, Zechariah should not have said this and questioned the angel. So the angel then answers him and says, "I am Gabriel." And that too must have struck a little fear in Gabriel and Zechariah's heart, because he knew who Gabriel was. You can read the book of Daniel. The angel Gabriel is mentioned there twice. Incidentally, there are three archangels mentioned in the Bible. Who are they? Michael, Gabriel, Lucifer, or Hillel in Hebrew. Lucifer is actually Latin translated in there instead of Hillel. So Gabriel, Michael, and Hillel, all of which have God in their names there. The name Gabriel, incidentally, means warrior of God or man of God there. That was the name of that angel there. So what is his role, Gabriel? If you read through the book of Daniel, find him mentioned twice in there. He is one who reveals the future to Daniel. He is essentially a prophet, if you will, as an angel. And what's he doing here? He's revealing the future to Zechariah, that he will have a son who will be the one who will prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. So the angel says, "I am Gabriel, who stands in the presence of God." Pretty powerful statement. "And was sent to speak to you and bring you these glad tidings. But behold, you will be mute and not able to speak until the day these things take place, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their own time." A little commentary on the word mute here. It's a Hebrew, a Greek word from a root that means silence. It can mean mute, somebody who's not able to speak. It can also mean deaf, somebody who's not able to hear, because, again, stemming from silence. There's silence when you can't hear, there's silence when you can't speak. It can mean both as well, because we find out later that actually, Zechariah is unable to speak and to hear, because a little later in the chapter, when the time comes to name his son, Yochanan, it says they made signs to his father what he would have his son named. Why are they making signs? They're making signs because Zechariah can't hear. So he's both mute and deaf there. Can't hear and can't speak. So again, this is a miracle to Zechariah, to emphasize to him the importance of what is taking place here. Now, it may sound, you know, we read this and, wow, that's pretty harsh for a man not to be able to hear or to speak for the next 9 or 10 months until his son is born. You know, it can strike us that way. But again, let's think it through. Is this really harsh? You know, Zechariah has just been told that he's going to have a son in his old age, and not just any son, but the son who would prophetically come and prepare the way for the coming of the Messiah. And a miracle is about to take place. They're going to have this son in their old age by miracle. And the angel Gabriel wants to leave Zechariah no doubt that this is indeed a miraculous intervention. So he tells him, "You're not going to speak, you're not going to hear for the next 9 months, until your son is born." So again, is this such a bad thing? Zechariah put yourself in his sandals for a while. In 9 months, he's going to have a son who's going to prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. Now, if an angel appeared to you and told you that, what would your reaction be? What? Me? How long is it going to take you to process that? Well, you're probably going to walk around in a daze for at least the next 4 or 5 months thinking, is this really happening? Is it really true? I'm going to be the father of the one who is coming to prepare the way for the coming of the Messiah. Is this such a bad thing? You know, what do we do with our kids when they need to focus? Put them in time out. I think this may have been God putting Zechariah in time out to focus and think about things. Because when are you close to God if not in silence? If not when you have time to sit and not be distracted by everything else going on, but to really focus on what God is doing in your life. I think that's the unstated story of what is going on here with Zechariah here. How many questions would race through your mind for the next 9 months? How do I rear this boy? What do I teach him? How do I teach him? How do I teach the one who's going to grow up and proclaim the way, prepare the way for the coming of the Messiah? All these questions that had to be racing through Zechariah's mind. If it happened to you or me, we would probably appreciate the time to focus and think on these things and to mentally prepare ourselves for this enormous responsibility that God has suddenly and miraculously placed on our shoulders. So if you think about it in these terms, I don't think it's that much of a punishment after all. It's a part of carrying out God's plan here with Zechariah and Elizabeth. Meanwhile, outside the temple, people are wondering, what's taking Zechariah so long? You know, what's going on here? Continuing the story here in verse 21, and the people waited for Zechariah and marveled, they wondered, in other words, that he lingered, that he took so long in the temple. What's taking this guy so long? I mean, we've come to the temple, we do this every day, it never takes this long. What's going on in there? But when Zechariah came out, he could not speak to them, and they perceived that he had seen a vision in the temple, for he beckoned to them. He gestured, in other words, and remained speechless. He's trying to say, can't talk, you know, something happened in there, you know, the guy with wings came down and appeared here, you know, and I can't talk, you know. So some parts of this story are really kind of funny if you think about it. You know, think about it. Zechariah is deaf and mute, and he goes home and tells his wife they're going to have a baby, and he's 80 and she's 70, and he can't speak and talk. How does he explain that to her? That had to be one interesting sign language conversation going on there. So, but anyway, attempt at humor there, very very little humor. But anyway, so he comes out and he's unable to speak. So he's gesturing, trying to convey to people what happened here. And so it was, verse 23, as soon as the days of his service were completed, that he departed and went back to his own house. His course, that week's service ended, and he returns back to home to be with Elisheba and to explain what all has gone on there. That had to be one very interesting reunion there, as I say. So continuing the story, verse 24, we're almost wrapped up here. Now after these days, his wife Elizabeth conceived, and she hid herself 5 months, saying, thus the Lord has dealt with me in the days when he looked on me to take away my reproach among people. And again, think of what she has been through for decades of being ostracized, of being looked down on, of rumors being spread around her about some secret sin that she had to be participating in for God to have cursed her and punished her like this. And in the end, she is vindicated in a powerful, powerful way by giving birth to the one who would prepare the way for the coming of the Lord. Why did she hide herself away 5 months? The Bible doesn't say, but again, think about the context. She's quite elderly, 60, 70 years old perhaps. She probably wants to make sure she doesn't lose the baby at her age, so she probably kind of confines herself to the house and there to confining herself to bed rest so she doesn't lose the baby. Perhaps another thing, perhaps like what I described with Zechariah, he's in time out for 9 months. Maybe Elizabeth's doing the same thing. Maybe the realization of how their lives are changing and what God is miraculously doing to them is sinking in, and she needs time to process that. And think of the same questions that are going through Zechariah's mind. How am I going to teach this boy? What do I teach him? How do I bring him up? Why us, God? Why us? Why are we chosen to give birth to the one who will prepare the way for the coming of the Lord? Yes, Arthur?
Seeing the prayer that they have are parallels, and we have parallels here with Daniel talking about Zacharias and Mary and Joseph, they go on along.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Luke actually switches back and forth between Jesus and John in parallel stories. Starts this storyline, interrupts it, shows the parallel, which we'll get into next time, with another angel, same angel, Gabriel, appearing to another woman whose womb is barren. Barren because she's young, not because she's old. And the same thing, the angel appears and says, you're going to give birth to one who has been foretold in prophecy for centuries before that. So yes, a lot of parallels there. And Luke, I mentioned also in the introduction of the background of Luke, one of the things I commented is that Luke includes a lot of women and children in his stories, which the other Gospels don't. And here's a classic example of that. Devotes so much time to Elizabeth. And as we'll see next time, an awful lot of time to Miriam, the mother of Jesus. So that's all I have for us today. Any other questions for anyone here? Yes, Barry.
Well, just a certain topic today, too. It was pretty strongly suggested by a lot of the religious leaders of the day that some of us should actually have a sort of a religious duty to divorce a wife who's barren.
True, yes.
Right.
Yeah, especially being a priest, because, yeah, that was a double burden on them to be a priest. You're God's representative, and you can't have children? Why, that's just unthinkable. So yes, a number of the rabbis, there were different rabbinical schools. I should point out that, too. Not all rabbis believed that, but some of them did say, yes, if your wife is barren, divorce her. Move on to another one. So. Any other questions from anyone? Okay, if not, we'll get set up then for the mystery dinner. Scott, any particular